Welcome. You are about to join the story of Lioness. Listen as host and author Diane Pendola brings you the Lioness Tale. Now it's time to come together and awaken to the liberating spirit that lives at the center of each of our lives. Here's Diane Pendola.
Hello, this is Diane Pendola, and I'm very happy to be hosting this show based on my book, The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. Today, we will be welcoming intercultural philosopher and an old friend of mine, Roger Rapp, to our show for what I anticipate to be a great discussion and conversation about such issues as essence, being, time, and some other issues that I think people will find of current interest. So we will talk with Roger in the second segment after we go to break. But I do like to begin each of these shows with an invitation to settle down, to center, to come into awareness of the present moment. The show is about being and essence, so let's take a moment to come into contact with being, come into contact with the core of who we are. Being is present-centered awareness. It is only in the present that we can connect to the core of who we are. So wherever you are breathing, and the breath is a great way to connect with the moment and with ourselves. So just take a moment, come into breath, and become open and receptive to the message of this show and to our conversation. Last week, we read the foreword of The Lioness Tale and welcomed Hal Zina Bennett to our show. This week, we will focus our discussion on the prologue to The Lioness Tale. Those of you who are familiar with the prologue of the Gospel of St. John in the New Testament, we'll hear an echo of that in the prologue of The Lioness Tale. The light calls our lioness out of darkness, out of mystery, where all exists only in potential, and calls her into life, into form. In her, as in us, the light becomes flesh and lives among us. So let's listen for a moment to the prologue of John's Gospel, and then to the prologue of our story. And once again, we are joined by Teresa Hahn, who will be the narrator and the voice of The Lioness Tale throughout our show. So here's Teresa.
From the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word was the true light which illuminates all who come into this world. And the Word became flesh and lived among us. The prologue to The Lioness Tale. Once upon timefulness, all is a limitless expanse of space. Imagine the most wonderful velvet feel. Imagine a deep, rich, luxuriant blackness, even beyond imagining. There is no fear in this black spaciousness, no struggle in this expansive beingness. It just is. And within it lies the potential of all that might come to be. Every form is latent here, waiting for the light from which it receives its unique life. From this black velvet space, the story of Lioness takes shape. It is here that the light finds her, calls to her. She feels a stirring take place in the darkness, a desire to respond to this light that is calling her name with such love. Her response begins to take on a form. Large golden paws join long forelegs, which stretch into muscled shoulders. A strong neck supports a regal head from which two eyes gaze out like fiery suns, each spinning around a black center of infinite peace. Her back is long and elegant and slopes into haunches that ripple with power. Her underbelly is soft and covered with fine white and yellow hairs with the feel of feathered down. She shakes her great head with the sheer exuberance of life and bounds through that great space, her rightful home, with power and grace. The light is within her. She is the light. Through this light she has come to be. She is Lioness, and she roars the sacred sound of her name through that space, the way waves rolling in from the deep sea might roar upon the shore. And now it comes to pass that upon the shores of time, she is carried from that timeful place. She is born, and with the memory of the dark and the light forever reflected in the orb of her fiery gaze, she enters the world of beginnings and endings.
Before I comment more on these two prologues, I would like to introduce you to an ancient system of psychological and spiritual transformation called the Enneagram. Ennea is a Greek word for nine and gram for something drawn, as in diagram. So the Enneagram is a nine-pointed figure drawn to represent nine distinct ways of seeing the world. It represents nine personality types, and it also represents nine essential or higher states of being. And we will be using the Enneagram as a framework for understanding our story throughout our show over the coming weeks. But today I would like to introduce you to the essential or higher states of the Enneagram. So imagine with me, if you will, the light that calls our lioness into life. It is the light that shines in the darkness. It is the light that takes flesh, that takes form. In the book, we have a quote that precedes the prologue to the Lioness Tale from my dear teacher and mentor, Ramon Panikkar. He says, and I quote, "Light in itself is darkness, cannot be seen, is invisible. In order to become luminous, it needs me, an opaque body. Without me, light would indeed be darkness. And without light, I would be nothing." Now, that could sound a little opaque or dense in itself, and so I think it deserves and can use a second reading, so let me read it one more time. "Light in itself is darkness, cannot be seen, is invisible. In order to become luminous, it needs me, an opaque body. Without me, light would indeed be darkness, and without light, I would be nothing." In other words, the light needs me, the light needs you. In order to be seen, to be felt, to be experienced, the light needs form. According to the Enneagram, when this eternal light comes into human form, we experience it as these higher states of being, or essential states. We experience this divine light, so to speak, as love, as perfection, freedom, hope, source, knowledge or transparency, faith, wisdom, truth. And these are the nine essential qualities named by the Enneagram. I find it helpful to imagine it this way. A beautifully cut diamond is held up to a light source. As the light hits the diamond, the light is refracted into color. Not just one color, but many colors. Even though the light hitting the diamond is one beam of light, when it strikes the form of the diamond, we experience the light as blue, green, violet, a whole spectrum of color. In the same way, when the divine light shines through our lives without obstruction, which of course is the key here, in other words, when we are transparent to this light, not only do we experience the refraction of the light, first at the entry point of love, and then into faith and hope, freedom and truth, and all the essential states of the Enneagram, but others experience these qualities as well. These essential states are what we experience when we are in the presence of someone we feel is a sage or a saint or a holy person. These states radiate presence, and this presence is our true nature, what the Buddhists might call our face before we were born. As Panikkar says, the light needs us. It is invisible till it finds form to shine through. So we're going to go to break now, and when we come back, we'll be joining Roger Rapp, and we'll continue this conversation about essence, being, and light. Awakening the Liberating Spirit, and I want to welcome Roger Rapp. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Diane.
Roger's a PhD. He's an interreligious and cross-cultural philosopher, a student also of Ramon Panikkar, and we go back to UCSB where he got his doctoral degree in cross-cultural religious studies. So we're longtime friends, and I'm really happy to have you joining us today for this conversation about being and time and essence and God and some important things. So, Roger, you describe yourself as a philosopher who never could quit his day job. Could you tell us something about yourself as a philosopher and what philosophy means to you?
Well, of course, that was a little joke, I guess, echoing the, hey, Diane, listen to my song, and I play my song, and that's great, Roger, but don't quit your day job. But, you know, like we've so, in American culture, we've so internalized the institution that we can only see philosophy and art and the humanities as a career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Europe, philosophy is taught in the high schools. And here, it's not until university level that we begin philosophy, and it's a little bit too late. The forma mentis, the mindset, has already been set in concrete, I think, by then. And actually, I think it's through your day job that you can actually do authentic philosophy. Mm-hmm. Philosophy has to do with orienting ourselves to reality with a more or less critical awareness. Orientation, reality, critical awareness, mm-hmm. form three poles or three symbols basic to human life. And throughout the history of civilization, thinkers have been pondering, struggling, yearning to find the proper balance between action, understanding, and transcendence. Mm-hmm. So I think that's philosophy, a way of life that goes after finding this orientation to reality.
And we find it in our day job. In other words, we find it in our lived lives and in the day-to-day, I guess, chopping wood, carrying water, as
yes, indeed,
the saying goes. Yeah.
Yes, and I think the, you know, the economic mindset that we have prevents us from seeing that the real work is the daily life, and it's through daily life that you build spirituality or knowledge mm-hmm. of any sort.
So what are you working on these days in your daily life, bringing all of yourself to bear, your mind, body, and soul to bear on your daily life?
Well, philosophy. I have three kind of projects I've been working on recently. One is agrarian mysticism that touches a little bit on the themes of your eco-contemplative life at Skyline.
Mm-hmm.
that looks, it's a reflection on Wendell Berry and his relationship to the soil, which is the matrix where life and death meet, where out of death life emerges. So it's a meditation on a mystical experience coming out of the soil, coming out of the earth, a true ecosophy. Second theme I'm working on is critical awareness, and that's more a philosophical reflection on the role of the intellect, of reason, of cognition in this orientation to reality. You know, it's not just the cabbage between our ears. There's some reason that we have, you know, there's some purpose for having an intellect. And on the other hand, rationality is not necessarily the vehicle to finding an experience of the full reality. And so how do we balance? How do we find this? We don't live in a rational society, and when we try to impose a rationality, we often get into this institutional mode where we miss the real experience. Mm-hmm. So meditation on critical awareness and its role in the orientation to reality. Mm-hmm. And a third theme that's come up, and one I'd like to emphasize a little bit because it ties in with the themes of the Lioness Tale and confinement, incarceration, and so on, has been the recent debate on torture that's come out in the main media, finally, after 7 years, has become a hot topic in public discourse because of the revelations of Bush administration policymaking and actions by the Obama administration to reveal some of them, and apparently they're not going to reveal all of them, we find out today. So it's even in the news today, as you'll see. And war crimes have been committed by the United States, and the United States is not alone among the civilized nations, and we have made promises to these nations not to commit such crimes. And it's a very complex issue. But one very important aspect that's relevant to the discussion, our discussion here, is the difference between warfare and torture. And I saw a blog online sponsored by Andrew Sullivan and his Daily Dish, where the question is, what's the difference between warfare and torture? We do horrible things in war. What's the difference if we do horrible things in interrogation?
Well, that's a great question.
And I have a quote here from one of the readers of Andrew, or responders to Andrew Sullivan.
Uh-huh.
And so this is a quote. I was an interrogator for 7 years and taught interrogation for 3 of those years. The distinction that people are trying to grasp is a simple and fundamental one. During warfare, both sides are fighting each other. If you don't do unto him, he'll do unto you. When you capture a prisoner, they are your ward. You are responsible for them. How you treat them does not depend on what kind of person they are. It depends on what kind of person you are. That's what the Geneva Conventions are all about.
Oh, wow.
That's what used to be taught at interrogation school.
Uh-huh. What an important insight, because I think it does go to the heart of going to the prison system is where I go with it, but that that we need to find ways to treat people as our wards, as you're saying, that we don't want to sink down to the lowest common denominator and treat people poorly. We want to, and dehumanize them, we actually want to call them forward and humanize them, and that's our responsibility. I guess that's what I hear you saying.
Yes, it puts the burden on us in a way. How we treat the powerless prisoner, who is powerless in terms of physical freedom and the exercise of will, does not reveal the soul of the prisoner. It reveals our soul.
Absolutely.
No matter how wicked we think the prisoner is, no matter how many evil, destructive plots the prisoner is in on, mm-hmm. no matter how much the prisoner hates us, our culture, our values, our ideals, no matter how wrong, immoral, or disastrous his or her, you know, religion, society, ideology, thoughts may be, the truth is that how we treat the powerless prisoner only reveals our morality, our ideals, our soul. We are in charge. We're directing things. We have the power. We are the only responsible agents because we're the only free agents mm-hmm. in that scenario.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and it reflects the soul on a couple levels. It reflects the soul of myself as an individual or as a person, but it also reflects the soul of us as who we are as a society.
Yes.
And our core values as a society. And I think it goes to this whole conversation about being and essence. Do we move from a place of deep connection with essential being in the way we move in the world and what we're trying to create in our social structures, or are we moving more from a place of fragmentation and disconnection from that, which I see largely is happening in our prison system and is what's happening with torture?
Yes. I've been working, and we were talking a little bit about it the other day, of trying to make some kind of distinction between a guard and a guardian, because it's inevitable that there are going to be powerless people in society, and that we, or the state, or the community, or the family, or someone's going to have to take care of the powerless. And I think, in many ways, that links with the theme of the Lioness Tale. The marginalized, powerless people, mentally ill, homeless, poor, young, elderly, sick, disabled, illegal aliens, prisoners. Mm-hmm. These are the powerless in society, and how we deal with them, how we treat them, doesn't reveal anything about their moral worth. It reveals our actions reveal our core cultural values and manifests our ethical fiber.
Absolutely.
Reveals our soul. And so in a curious way, we have the powerless, including the prisoners, the young and the old and the disenfranchised, to thank, because they are the ones that reveal to us and bring out of us our own core values.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Well, that sounds like a good place to break. We're hearing the music now, which takes us to break. So we'll return to this when we come back. Thanks, Roger.
Okay.
You are listening to The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit, with your host, Diane Pendola. If you would like to contact Diane, please send an email to thelionesstale@gmail.com. Again, that's thelionesstale@gmail.com. Now back to our program.
Hello, welcome back. This is Diane Pendola, and this is The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. And we're speaking with Roger Rapp, a cross-cultural interreligious philosopher. And Roger, right before we went to break, I think you were beginning to talk about the distinction between the guardian and the guard. And I would imagine there's a difference in consciousness there and responsibility. So,
yes. The guard, interestingly, I looked up a little bit on the etymology of guard and guardian, and it's related to a root were, like guardia, they say in Spanish, is were. It means, it's related to awareness, to be aware, to be perceptive. And so the guard and the guardian, who are to defend and protect, first have to heighten their awareness. They have to heighten their perception in order to be able to defend or protect. But I think the difference between the two is the relationship to power. And I think the guard has exercises a kind of power over others, and in this case, the powerless in jail, the prisoner that we're talking about. And the guardian has a power for the person who is his or her ward that does exercises power in the interest of the other person who is the ward, who is unable to exercise power for themselves.
Well, there's definitely a different feel in the two words. I have guardian dogs because we have goats and sheep here, and the guardian dogs protect. You know, there's a sense when you say, oh, we have guardian dogs, there's an immediate feeling, oh, they're protectors. They're responsible for protecting their flock, where when you hear somebody has a guard dog, it feels a little scary.
like
oh, my gosh, I better be on my guard because I could get attacked. Yeah.
Well, power and responsibility have a fundamental connection or relationship, and that is as power increases, so too the call for responsibility, the call for a response out of an essence, if you want, or out of your ethical core. And so, you know, you can take anything like, you know, you start with your hand, you know, I can hurt you a little bit with my hand if I hit you, and so I have a responsibility. But if I have a hammer, which is a tool that is a hand in made solid in iron, and I hit you, I have much more power. And so I have more responsibility to wield that hammer, that tool, responsibly.
So in a way that goes to the structure, like the structure of a system. Like I said last week in talking to Hal, that I think that our prison system in many respects is institutionalized dehumanization. So it's a hammer to the exponential degree. So
exactly. And institutions or pyramids of power, if you want, are ways, the fundamental way, the bureaucracy, the bureaucratic pyramidal structure that our institutions are, is the fundamental technology of power. That's how we build power. But as every step that power increases, there's a greater call for responsibility. And the difficulty of the modern age, the great crisis that we've brought upon ourselves, is that we've been able, through the industrial world, to exponentially increase power through these structures. And the problem is that while you can exponentially grow power through mass production, through all this technology and so on, industry, responsibility is always a personal affair.
Right.
Persons
That's what I'm
have to
thinking.
Take responsibility.
You know, what is our responsibility as citizens to address these power structures?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you have, and so that's why, as Ibn Illich says, these institutions ultimately begin to suppress that which they were instituted to promote. And so the prison system, which was instituted to, well, what was it instituted to do?
Well, you know, that has an interesting history. We thought that we were doing a good thing. It comes from actually a Christian perspective, a penitentiary, a place to do penance, a place to go to your cell and get and hopefully connect with your essence and repent for your sins. It's kind of an interesting history there.
So take some time out, get away from the situation you're in, find some solitude, and begin an interior journey to reflect on what you've done.
Yes. Of course, we've certainly gotten away with that from that, haven't we? I mean, the prisons are so overcrowded now. What's the? You were telling me what the space was per prisoner in some California prisons right now.
I think 6 square feet, something like that.
And they're so overcrowded. People are in gyms, and there's just no room at all for self-reflection or for...
And it becomes the university for crime.
Absolutely.
And it begins to, instead of making us safer, make us begins to threaten us,
mm-hmm.
Our own system, and it's threatening us, if nothing else, economically,
mm-hmm.
In California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a huge drain on our economic system.
And waste of lives. It's a huge drain on our human resources. These people in jail, and I think in the United States, under the justice, supervision of the justice system, there's 7.5 million people being supervised. Over 2 million in jail, and then others.
Right. When I wrote my thesis on incarceration back in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. The United States was third in incarcerating in the world per capita, behind the Soviet Union and China. And now we imprison more of our own people than any country on the planet. 1 out of 100, actually, people are in jail and prison, and 1 in 30 are under the long arm of the criminal justice system, in other words, on probation or parole or in some way, you know, wards of the state in that way.
And it takes, it drains from society, you know, our greatest resource, really, which is people,
mm-hmm.
which is our citizenry, and we make them powerless, and as a result, we become threatened by the institutions that we set in place in order to make us more secure.
So it does come back in a certain way as how we see ourselves, how we understand ourselves as people, how we understand ourselves as connecting to essence. What is this human enterprise about? I mean, are we meant as human beings to call forth each other's humanity into these essential states, into freedom, into truth, into love, into kindness, into compassion? And it goes to what you're saying about, you know, we're moral agents, and at our core, we need to look at these kinds of choices we're making. And I, of course, from my point of view, choose the higher road.
Mm-hmm.
So another thing I know that I think it's important, because I think we're kind of experiencing this difference between the individual and the person. I guess what I'm saying here is that we treat these people that are in prison, these people that we torture, they're not the other. They are actually part of ourselves, because we are all connected, and that we do kind of create our reality by the choices we make. And so I think this goes to the whole distinction between the individual and the person, which you had mentioned in a conversation earlier. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Well, the individual is that which can no longer be divided, the indivisible.
Mm-hmm.
Individuals can be counted and plugged into equations. Individuals can be counted because individuality ends with the body. If we weigh the value of 80 million German individuals versus 6 million Jewish individuals, then does not simple math tell us that it's better to get rid of the 6 million for the well-being of the 80 million? For the security of 300 million American individuals today, is it not rational to toss 7.5 million individuals in jail or put them under the supervision of the justice system?
Mm-hmm.
But we're something more than individuals. The person is the mass, the persona, is from Greek theater, the mask that they wore, and they spoke through the mask, the persona, to sound through. The person is the mask or the face through which we speak. The person is the symbol of who we are. As such, a person cannot be counted or calculated. A little example that Panikkar gives, maybe we'll have to talk about it when we get back.
Yeah, it sounds like we're going to go to break, but great. Hold that thought, and we'll talk about that when we get back. Thanks, Roger.
Okay.
Hello, welcome back to The Lioness Tale, and we're speaking with Roger Rapp, and Roger was just about to share with us an example from Panikkar, our teacher and mentor to both of us, about how to distinguish between the individual and the person, I think, weren't you, Raj?
Right, the individual and the person, and we talked a little about the individual being undivided and being countable. But the person, you can't count the person. The person, my person, doesn't stop at my fingertips. It extends to my parents, my family, my neighbors, my community. There's no clear-cut division between them. It's a little bit like the way that your face is a symbol of who you are. My face is a symbol of who I am. And I am more than my face, my body and my thoughts and my essences and my light. But my face is a symbol of who I am. And if you punch my face, you punch me. Mm-hmm. There is no break between, you know, there's no division mm-hmm. between. And it's this person, this experience of our connectedness, of our web of connections, with each other and with the cosmos and
so that
reality.
My person is connected to the person in prison.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that there's a certain unity or oneness or interconnection anyway between us, that there's not a separation between us. That what affects one of us affects both of us.
Affects both of us. And we're not the same. We're not interchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a unity, but at the same time, there's no way to divide or say, here's where I end, I, Roger, end, and you, Diane, begin.
Mm-hmm.
We overlap,
mm-hmm.
although I can't replace you and you can't replace me.
Mm-hmm.
Our person, you can't count persons.
Right.
You can't count persons. You can't weigh one person against 300 million or 80 million, like we were talking about.
Right.
Other.
It's not just an exchange of numbers.
It's not an exchange.
Quality rather than quantity.
It's a matter of quality, uh-huh. and that quality extends to all our experiences. And as in the prologue that Teresa read for us, the beginning is not in the Gospel of John is not referring to chronological time. It's mm-hmm. not talking about individual units of time that you can count, you know, with your chronometer, with your watch, and keep track of. This in the beginning, in principio or in arche, in the Latin and Greek versions, refers to the origins, the beginning of all things.
Mm-hmm. So we're back to the. An experience of an essential state there at the origins.
There at the
we're
origins.
About
and it's as a person
again.
that we experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that beginning to which the prologue and your timefulness, which is a nice interpretation and echoing of the gospel, is, you know, refers to an experience of time in its full dimensions. That takes place right now. Mm-hmm. The beginning is a continual beginning. The beginning is the beginning of every moment mm-hmm. that we experience, and that were this beginning not with us, we wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. I think. Isn't yes. that what you were trying to say?
Yeah, and in the prologue to The Lioness Tale, I take that past tense from John's Gospel into present tense in the prologue to The Lioness Tale, because this experience of being, of essential states, of the beginning, of the fullness of time isn't in the past, it isn't in the future, it's right here and it's right now. And even though the lioness in her journey gets disconnected from her essential nature, from the sense of being, it didn't go away. It's not somewhere else. It isn't something she has to earn back. It's something that she needs to, in a certain way, relax back into or surrender back into.
It's available every moment.
It's available every moment.
Mm-hmm. And in that sense, the beginning and all time, if you want, is available at every moment if we learn how to open ourselves to the transcendence of our individuality.
Mm-hmm. And that also then takes us to the sense of... I lost my thought, I'm sorry.
The time that is in the beginning is all the time that is available to all of us. Mm-hmm. And it's through the experience of the now, which, interestingly, even Einstein said that the problem for science is not the past or the future, it's the now. Mm-hmm. If your time, sense of time is chronological, if you're counting seconds, which are uniform packets of something we call time, the now is simply a zero point, a transition between past mm-hmm. and future. Mm-hmm. But in the experience of the person, when we open ourselves to our personhood and not just being an individual different from others, then the now, we experience the now as this timefulness that you're talking about, this fullness where, if you will, eternity and temporality intersect.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think I remember what I was going to say. It was going to security, because we're kind of obsessed with security in our culture.
Yes.
Our prison system is a reflection of that. Our this conversation about torture is a reflection of that. And if we're really connected at this place that we're talking about, it's a place of cosmic confidence. Ramon Panikkar talks about cosmic confidence, but it's in the present. It's a trust in reality. It's a trust in being. It's a trust in ourselves and each other, that we don't have to live out of fear and out of this need for security, if we can connect deeply with the core of who we are.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well said.
Well, maybe if that's well said, that's a good place to wrap it up. I really want to thank you, Roger, for being with us today. And it was a great conversation and a lot to think about.
Thank you so much for inviting me on your show. I'm very excited about it. I think it's starting to take shape, and I think over the coming weeks, it'll as you get your sea legs, it's going to be a wonderful radio series.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Raj. So I just want to make an announcement here that one of the hopes is coming from this radio show is that we're creating an in-prison project called the Lioness Tale Prison Project, and we want to take this show and some of the and the Lioness Tale, the book itself, into prisons and help people gain access to the liberating spirit that lives in the core of their lives, no matter what their external circumstances might be. So if you'd like to know more about that, or if you'd like to be a sponsor, you can go to the website, thelionesstale.com, and learn more about that. If you're interested in the book, you can go to our website, www.ecocontemplative.com, and learn how to buy our book and learn about our services here at Skyline Harvest. So thank you so much for joining us. Next week we'll be reading the book, the first third of the book. So please join us for that. Thanks again. Take care. See you next week.
Author of The Lioness Tale, minister and Enneagram teacher Diane Pendola is the director and co-founder of Skyline Harvest, an eco-contemplative center in the Sierra foothills of Northern California. Living on 200 private acres with wooded trails and spectacular views, she offers Lioness Tale workshops, Enneagram consultations, and retreat opportunities. Diane created and conducts an in-prison transformational program called the Lioness Tale Prison Project. At Skyline Harvest, as well as inside prison walls, she advances the theme of her Voice America radio show, The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. If you are interested in sponsoring this life-changing program for people inside prison, or if you wish to purchase Diane's book, schedule a consultation, retreat, or workshop at Skyline Harvest, contact Diane at www.ecocontemplative.org or call 530-288-0308. Again, that's ecocontemplative.org or call 530-288-0308.
Love, serve, and remember to love.